Welcome to episode 425 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Dr. James Sprague on the topic of durability. This was the main topic of James' PhD, so he is the perfect guest to discuss the latest scientific findings on this topic, which, as it is a pretty new research topic, is something that is moving along quite quickly. So it was really interesting to get an update on everything that's happened. And of course, some of these findings come directly from James's research. But before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. Precision Fuel and Hydration help athletes personalize their hydration and fueling strategies for training and racing. You can use the free Fuel and Hydration Planner to get a personalized plan for your carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid intake in your next event. And if you want even more help, why not book a free 20-minute video consultation to chat through your plan with the athlete support team? As a TTS listener, you get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Zenate. The Zenate Indoor Swim Trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. You can target specific aspects of your stroke, like your catch and pull through, and you can work on technique or power. The design of the bench forces you to constantly work on core activation, which can help your body position in the water. And most importantly, you can stay consistent in your training even when you don't have time to go to the pool. Try the Zenate risk-free for 30 days and get 20% off your first order on zenatesintra.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with James Sprague. Welcome back to That Triathlon Show, James. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Thank you very much for having me back.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. It's been a little while. I actually don't remember off the top of my head what episode the last one was or what year it was, but there are plenty of new listeners regardless. So let's start with a reintroduction of yourself to the audience.
Okay, yeah. I think my two appearances on the podcast have bookended my PhD, basically. My name's James Sprague. I have a PhD now in exercise science from the University of Cape Town, specializing in durability. So that's what I looked at during my PhD studies. I work for Tudor Pro Cycling. So I work as a coach and I guess kind of performance scientist as well alongside that role. And then I also work for a company that I have with some colleagues who've also been on the podcast, Intercept Performance Consultancy. And we work across a wide range of sports providing performance consultancy, essentially.
And Tudor Pro Cycling, what level do they race at?
So we are a pro team. So there's three levels of professional cycling. We're in the middle tier. It's a very new team. So you can't go straight in at the top tier. You have to qualify for the top tier by scoring points. So we're in that middle tier at the moment, but with
all right
conditions, I would say.
Cool. Yeah. So as you said, durability was the main topic of your PhD. So that's something that we will discuss in depth here. I thought that maybe it's good to start with some definitions. First of all, how would you define durability?
Durability is the difference in performance capacity from the start to the end of a single session, if you like. So it's essentially, what can you do when you're tired compared to what can you do when you're fresh is the easiest way to describe it.
Yeah. And you measure that in some of your papers, at least in various ways. It can be, but one of the ways that you measure it is with the change in mean max powers, I guess, but also critical power. Can you explain more clearly how it is measured and the additional terms that we might need to be familiar with to understand the research that you've done?
Yeah, sure. So I guess the good point to start is the power duration relationships. That's the power output you can produce for certain periods of time. If you plot all those durations and all those powers on a graph, you get a nice power duration curve. And what we're looking for are changes in that curve over time. So one of the terms you'll probably hear me say in this kind of podcast is the downward shift. So that's a shift of that power duration relationship downwards. So essentially now, instead of being able to produce, so for example, 400 watts for 10 minutes, you can do 380 watts for 10 minutes. So it's the whole curve has shifted downwards. Now, depending on the setting, how you measure performance changes. So sometimes you can do formal performance tests. And in those cases, you can test for things like critical power, so that maximal aerobic sustainable power. You can test for W prime, that ability to produce power above critical power, or the fixed work capacity that you can produce above critical power. maximum sprint power, which obviously kind of speaks for itself. So in formal testing environments, you can get those sort of values plus, you know, what athletes can do for 3 minutes or 12 minutes or 5 minutes or whatever durations you test. In more applied settings, in real world settings, obviously you can't get your athletes to do, you know, a test at the end of a race, during a race. And in those circumstances, we use what's called MMP values, so mean maximal power output values. So that's essentially the highest average power for a continuous duration of time. So for example, what is the highest average power across a 5 minute continuous period of time in a race, or a 10 minute, or you can use whatever durations you want. So when we're taking data from races, we typically use MMP values. When we're taking data from formal testing values, we will take the testing values and then derive the critical power and the W prime from those tests.
Yeah, great explanation. So one of the studies that you did was the relationship between training characteristics and durability in professional cyclists across a competitive season. So do you want to start with this one and give a bit of an overview of what you did and what you found?
Yeah, I think so. Just taking one step back from that. So when I came into my PhD, the research that myself had been involved in, some colleagues and some other groups had kind of shown that, okay, durability is important. So we knew that durability was a component of performance. So it wasn't just fresh values that counted. They weren't very predictive of actual race performances, but we knew durability was. And so the first question we had in my PhD was, okay, is it trainable? So can we get better at it? And is it fixed throughout a season? So if it was a fixed component, we actually wouldn't need to do much study in it, because we'd know, okay, everyone after 2,500 kilojoules of work can do 97%, or, you know, there's no individual variability, or there's no individual variability across a season. So that was the first thing we wanted to answer. We wanted to see, okay, is it fixed across a season? And actually, it's not. So what we saw in the study was that the fresh power profile was very similar across an entire season. So there was only very small changes across an entire season in, you know, maximal fresh values. However, there was far more variability in the power outputs in a fatigue state. So actually, sometimes when athletes thought they were in good form, it was more that actually, you know, their fresh numbers hadn't changed, but their fatigue numbers were much better. And that's what they were describing as form, because obviously that was having a bigger effect on their kind of performances in race. So we were the first kind of people to show that actually, okay, this concept durability, it does change throughout the season. And if it changes throughout a season, then obviously it must be trainable, right? Because we train throughout a season. So we wanted to understand how it was trainable. And what we did is we took a whole group of under 23 athletes, and we broke their season down into three chunks, so early, mid, and late. And now for each of these athletes, each of these periods had a goal event. So we knew that at some point they were trying to be in the best form possible during each of those three periods. We then looked at, we had performance testing in these three periods as well. So we looked at, okay, the performance testing, and that showed that, okay, the fresh level isn't changing too much in the performance tests. And then what we did is we looked at the power outputs they were producing at the end of races. So we used after 2,500 kilojoules. And we said, okay, we'll take MMP values, those power outputs from races after 2,500 kilojoules, and we'll see, okay, what are they doing at the end of races, you know, compared to what they can do in a fresh state. And what we actually saw is towards the end of the season, a big drop in what athletes were able to do in a fatigue state compared to a fresh state. So early season, they were relatively close. In the middle part of the season, actually the two kind of narrowed even again, and the athletes became more durable, not statistically, but actually, you know, the numbers were closer. And at the end of the season, those two values from fresh and fatigued diverged again. So we saw this change in the durability fatigue power outputs, but not in the fresh power outputs across the season.
And what were your conclusions from that, or are there any implications of these findings that you could then potentially use in coaching, in consultations with athletes and with other coaches?
Yeah, sure. So what we also did alongside is just looking at the power outputs, we looked at the training that the athletes did in those periods. And then what we did is we looked at correlations between the change in training from one period to the next and the change in durability from one period to the next. And what we found is that essentially training load is really important. So overall training load, if you reduce your overall training load, you're likely to become less durable. So you can almost, and what we found is a lot of athletes at the end of the season almost switched to like a minimal effective dose of training because, you know, they were getting a bit tired towards the end of the season to maintain their fresh power profile. But when they did that, obviously their overall training load reduced, they did less volume, and therefore their durability really suffered. So we saw that overall training load is really important. Volume of training, because obviously in endurance sports that forms a lot of the training load, is also really important. And what we found is that there's two ways essentially you can maintain your durability. You can increase, you can maintain your volume, or you can decrease your volume a little bit, and you can kind of increase the amount of sort of gray zone training that you do. So that heavy intensity, sweet spot training, whatever you're going to call it, you can kind of compensate a little bit by doing a little bit more of that and keep your overall training load pretty much the same, even if you drop the volume a little bit. However, in the athletes that improve their durability, basically they increase their volume and went slightly more polarized in their training. So if you want to, you can maintain by doing more heavy intensity work, kind of sweet spot, gray zone, whatever you're going to call it, and reduce your volume a little bit. Or you can improve your durability, and to do that, you need to kind of polarize your training a little bit by increasing the volume.
Right. Yeah. I remember having this discussion with your colleague Peter Leo, who was also involved in some of these studies, yeah. And I think one of the studies that he was the main author for was based on this similar data, but with some slightly different research questions that you were investigating. But I had this discussion with him where I asked the question that when you do have cyclists coming to the end of the season and they are tired, is it because of the maybe distributing the training not optimally throughout the year, or maybe it's just in an inevitability with all of the racing that they do, all of the race days, making it hard to have the freshness. Basically, what I'm asking is when you have, there is a reason that they're dropping their volume, as you say, they feel tired. Is it feasible when you do get to that point and you feel tired to force yourself to increase volume or maintain volume, or is it more that you need to adjust what you did before, earlier in the season, in the year, whether it's training or racing, to be able to do that later in the season?
I would say there's an awful lot of kind of psychological fatigue across the season. So especially in professional cycling, the guys do a lot of days away from home. They do a lot of travel days. You know, it's a lot of time in airports. There's all that side of things as well. And I think that takes a kind of a mental toll across the season as well. And what we see is in the athletes that, you know, if you're, so Tour de Lombardia is, you know, Giro de Lombardia is right at the end of the season. You know, in the guys that's a real goal for, don't really have problem maintaining that volume towards the end of the season because they're still focused, they're still motivated for that goal. And probably, yes, you have adjusted the training load throughout the season a little bit to build, you know, in for that, if that makes sense. So it's probably, I think the thing with fatigue is it's always so complex. Like you can't pin it down to one variable. Do you know what I mean? You have mental fatigue, you have cognitive fatigue, you have physical fatigue, you have, you know, and that can be split up into multitude of different components itself. And that's what makes it so fascinating, but it also makes it very hard to pin down exactly why athletes are slowing down or not able to train as much or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes total sense. And perhaps even the knowledge now, these findings can help provide an additional point of motivation for athletes that, okay, that there seems to be this link between maintaining or even maintaining training load, increasing training volume, and in that way maintaining or increasing the durability, which will help race performance. So maybe just the knowledge that is going to be beneficial can make you feel good about doing the training even in those last few months of the season.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't also think that seasons shouldn't be seen kind of, you know, in isolation. Like you're also setting yourself up for the next season, right? So if you've lost a load of durability towards the back end of one season, that's a load of work that you need to do at the front end of the next season in order to bring that back to get up to the level to, you know, to be competitive in the early season races. So I think there's also, you have to consider it in terms of like a season to season performance metric as well. And I think that's why we see in cycling, you know, guys that in male cycling, guys that finish the Vuelta for example, really strong, big volume, big intensity load at the end of the season, finish that, go to a few more races, then take a good break, then they're already going well coming into the next season.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. Is there anything else from this particular study that you want to highlight, or should we move on to the next one?
I think what I would say is, you know, these are just general directions to follow for coaches in terms of their training prescription. Like, you know, we know that, okay, if you can increase volume, then likelihood is that's the way to increase durability. But obviously, there's an individual response at the same time. So you just, it tells you a direction you can maybe go with an athlete, but it doesn't tell you how much to, you know, to increase the duration by or the volume by. And obviously, if that's making an athlete tired, then obviously you're also going to see a drop in performance. So it's the idea with this study was just to get a good idea of, okay, in which direction does training need to go? You know, do we need to intensify training or do we need to increase volume? What do we need to do in order to improve durability? And then obviously that has to be applied at like an individual level. And that's obviously the skill of an individual coach to be able to do that.
Yeah. The next study that I wanted to ask about is the relationship between physiological characteristics and durability in male professional cyclists. So there you took the cyclists into the lab and investigated a bunch of physiological markers and variables and how they correlated with durability. So can you discuss that in some more detail?
Yeah, sure. This is my favorite study for my PhD, so I can talk about this one. I like this one. So what we did is we wanted to understand the physiology. So, okay, we know it's trainable. We know durability is trainable. So there must be something going on at a physiological level, right? That's, we're seeing differences in, or we're moving a needle in some components. And that's, you know, given us increased durability. So what are the things, you know, where are we moving the needle was the next question we had. So what we did is we got athletes to do an extended lab test protocol. So we did a normal kind of ramp test as you would do. And we also did some steady state stuff in the moderate and heavy exercise intensity domains, looking at exercise efficiency and looking at substrate utilization as well. We then got the athletes to do a fresh critical power test, so a power profile test, as we call it. So that's looking at their peak power. We then do a 3 and a 12 minute test, and from that we can derive our critical power and our W prime values. And then we did a fatiguing protocol, and then we got them to do the same critical power the same test to derive the critical power values again. And then we looked at correlation. So we looked at, you know, what are we seeing in the lab and those traditional lab measures, and what correlates nicely to those athletes that are more durable. We split that up, and this is where it gets a little bit confusing, because other studies have tried to do similar and not found the same results as us, and I'll maybe get into why I think that is. So what we found was that critical power durability, so that ability to maintain maximal kind of aerobic sustainable power output, correlates pretty well with everything. So any basic measure that you will take in a typical lab test, if you improve that, you'll likely see an improvement in durability of critical power. Okay. W prime doesn't really correlate with much at all. So the athletes that were more durable in terms of W prime, the only thing that correlated there was substrate utilization. So those that used less carbohydrates in the heavy exercise intensity domain, they maintained their W prime a little bit better than the others. So it seems for the W prime, okay, you need to be able to spare glycogen essentially when going pretty hard. And that's important because we know glycogen is important for those high intensity efforts. That kind of, you know, logically makes sense. For critical power, basically, like, just get fitter. It's a very simple way of kind of putting it. And actually, if we look at relative VO2 max, LT1, so where that first threshold falls, and substrate utilization, we can actually get a very good prediction of durability for critical power. So we can predict, you know, 98% of the variance in kind of critical power, or the drop in critical power, just with those three measures alone. Now, other studies have tried to do similar. And so they've looked at performance in a fresh and a fatigue state and the difference, and then correlated that back to lab metrics. And they found no correlations. And I think the reason for that is some of the studies didn't control the fatiguing element of the protocol particularly well. So it was done kind of in the field, a little bit loose, if you like. So I think some athletes had kind of more fatigue than others coming into their second test. And also they used a single performance metric. So some of the, one of the papers, for example, used a 20-minute test. Now, obviously for a 20-minute test, we understand that that's a product of both critical power and W prime. And we know there's only one component that, you know, that we found that, that correlates to W prime or changes in W prime. That substrate utilization wasn't measured in their particular study. So I think this is where there's some confusion in the literature at the moment, but I just think, don't think some of the studies have controlled enough for some of their components. And that's why they found different than we have.
Yeah. Yeah. With the maintenance of, or the durability of W prime, I should say, and the correlation with glycogen sparing, so substrate utilization, is that, do you think are the athletes that are better able to maintain a W prime also the ones that might have a lower W prime to begin with, or is that, did you look
into
that?
We didn't see any correlations there, so we saw no correlations to critical power or W prime values in a fresh state to durability. So that was quite interesting. So it's not like if you just get fitter, but actually if you just improve your critical power, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to become more durable. It's more those basic aerobic measures like VO2 max, where that first threshold is, exercise economy, substrate utilization, those kind of more basic values that actually seem to correlate with durability rather than, you know, just what you can do in a fresh state.
Yeah. And it is interesting. This is probably not scientifically correct to do this, but I just put down all the variables in a list ranked by how strong the correlation was, the R square value, and VO2 max was the one that had the strongest correlation. So that is quite interesting because it's not something that you would intuitively think that a high VO2 max is so strongly correlated to durability. That VO2 max is kind of seen conventionally as something that is more, well, reflective of what you can do over a short duration of very high intensity, but not necessarily what you can do in the fourth hour of a cycling race, for example. But it is very interesting to see the link between all of those basic aerobic variables and efficiency variables as well, and durability.
Yeah, definitely. And I think when you think about it, you know, the three that came out when we did the multiple linear regression, VO2 max tells you about, you know, how big the aerobic engine is.
Yep.
The substrate utilization tells you about, you know, how well that engine burns fuel and how well it saves the fuel that you need for those high intensity efforts again. And then the exercise economy tells you about, you know, how efficient that engine is. So it kind of makes sense when you look at the three that came together to give us durability. It kind of assesses all three sides of, you know, of how efficiently you basically turn oxygen intake into, you know, power at the pedal.
Yeah. And one more question about the protocol you used for fatiguing the cyclist. Was this one of the studies where you used the interval protocol with, I think it was something like 8-minute intervals at 105% to 110% of critical power?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so fatiguing protocols are tricky to come up with in scientific studies. The reason being is that you need something that is hard enough that it, you know, separates out the athletes. So some are still durable, some are, you know, getting fatigued. It can't be too hard that it puts everyone on the knees, because then, you know, you just get rubbish data at the other end. It needs to be relatively ecologically valid. Do you know what I mean? Like, it needs to look something like a bike race or something like whatever you're trying to test. And athletes have to want to do it multiple times. So obviously you do a familiarization, then you do it again in the testing, whatever else. So trying to find something that hits all those four boxes can be a bit tricky, and it took quite a bit of trial and error. And interestingly, when we first tried this, the 5x8 session, we ran the numbers. We did, you know, a small trial study with some athletes, and the numbers were complete garbage. Like we saw exactly the opposite of what we expected to see. So we saw the athletes that we expected to be more durable were actually less durable according to the test, and the athletes that were more durable actually were what we thought were the weaker athletes. And we couldn't quite understand what was going on. And then we dug into the data a little bit, and we saw that the athletes that had basically undercooked all the intervals, so they'd done them just under critical power rather than just over critical power, came out really strong in the test at the end. Some of the athletes had overcooked a little bit, And actually, they'd really pushed in each of the 5 minutes, sorry, each of the 8 minutes, and then they'd really suffered in the test at the end. And so we had to be really careful about having this control of 105 to 110% and making sure all the efforts were within that to control the fatiguing kind of element of the protocol. Otherwise, the numbers that you got out, the kind of the inter-individual variability in the level of fatigue induced was too great. So you have to be quite tight with your controls in terms of like when you're inducing fatigue, to kind of get some to get some useful data at the other end.
And we'll get to the impact of this kind of intermittent high intensity protocol versus just grinding out steady power in the next study, but just a couple of follow-ups still on this one. So first of all, everything that improves your fitness in the lab physiologically might then be correlated to durability based on this. So is it as simple as get fitter and get better durability at the same time, or are there any other conclusions conclusions that you would draw from this study, or how would you summarize it?
I think in broad terms, yes, to be honest. And actually, if you look at the first two studies that we spoke about, it makes sense in terms of, you know, the training and the response that you would expect to that, and then an increase in durability. So if you were going to, you know, if your goal as a coach was to increase someone's exercise economy and to improve someone's substrate utilization in terms of using less carbohydrates at higher intensities, your go-to to cover those two bases would probably be volume, right? Mm. And actually, that's what we saw in the first study. We saw that increasing that volume also increases kind of, you know, your durability. And then in the lab study, we saw that, okay, the metrics that you've probably moved the needle on by doing increased volume are also the ones that correlate nicely to durability. So I think that was quite nice about the studies, these two studies, that they, you know, kind of gave us the same answer by asking different questions, which normally tells you, you know, you're on sort of the right track. But I think we see that, you know, those athletes with years and years of just good aerobic, well-controlled training behind them are typically the most, you know, durable athletes. And we see it in cycling with juniors, for example. So juniors nowadays are coming in with, you know, crazy numbers, but they can't do them in a fatigue state because they just haven't got those years and years and years of, you know, training volume behind them. And they haven't, you know, developed that kind of element of their physiology at the moment. But if you test their VO2 max or you test their, you know, 5 minute power output, it's absolutely huge. But can they do that in a fatigue state? Not so much.
Mm, yeah. And are there any other practical implications of this study? For example, one thing that comes to mind is, would you have athletes go into the lab and use that data to, for example, run it through the regression equations that you came up with to get an estimate of predicted durability, or would you rather just actually do a test for durability itself, if it's something that you test for at all, or rather than just seeing how they do in races?
Yeah, it depends on that. I think one thing I learned is that, you know, from your typical step or ramp test, you don't get everything. So we had to have those longer. So we had, after the kind of the ramp protocol, we had 6 minute stages, one in the moderate and one in the heavy exercise intensity domain, just to pull out some of those economy and substrate utilization values. So I would say in any sort of lab environment, those are definitely a win in terms of the data you get back from them. So I'd even myself now, if I have athletes go to the lab, I add those in at the end. You know, it takes an extra 20 minutes, but you get a lot more valuable data from it. I do know that in some institutional settings where they have limited access to athletes, they are doing exactly that. So they've added those, you know, those steady state stuff at the end, and then they are kind of giving the athletes a prediction of their durability as well, and using that to, you know, in their kind of in their metrics. So it is being used in the field with national federations, which is nice to see. So it's, you know, it's just another tool that we have in our toolbox, basically. You know, if you can test someone outside, then probably just go out and test the exact thing that you want to test. But if you don't have access to be able to do that for whatever reason, you know, busy race programs or only limited access to testing with athletes or whatever else, then it's a nice way to get an idea of durability from, you know, an extra 20 minutes in the lab, which is not so much.
Yeah, yeah. Any other takeaways from this one, or shall we move on to the next study?
One's covered.
All right. So the next one is a study where you investigated the impact of the intensity of the work done before in a fatiguing protocol, essentially, and how that impacts the downward shift, as you talked about how much power loss you see in that fatigued state. So give us an overview of that study.
Yeah. So obviously not all bike races look the same. So some are very intense, some are very easy, actually, relatively speaking, for a professional cyclist. You know, that's obviously linked to the topology and the terrain and things that it covers. And also we learned from the pilot testing that I spoke about earlier that, you know, if you don't control well for intensity in terms of your fatiguing protocols, you get very different results out. So once we knew kind of, okay, durability is important, this is how we train it, this is the physiology around it, we thought, okay, well, let's look at, you know, are there individual differences in how people respond to intensity? So what we did is we used the same fatiguing protocol, so our 5x8s, 105 to 110% of CP. But we also matched that, or actually they did slightly more work at a moderate intensity, so less than 70% of critical power. And we know from kind of internal data that that will be in the moderate intensity domain. And then we got them to do, obviously, a critical power, a power profile test, then a fresh state, and then one after each of these fatiguing protocols. And then we looked at the differences. So we actually included peak power in this one as well, or 15-second power. 15-second power, critical power, and W prime. And we looked at what changed, you know, after a high-intensity session and what changed after a moderate-intensity session.
Yeah, just a reminder for the listeners here, the moderate intensity domain is below your first threshold, below your LT1 or VT1. So meaning it's easy endurance riding, essentially. What were the findings?
So we found, even though for methodological reasons, they ended up doing a little bit more actual total work in the moderate condition, we saw much bigger changes after the high-intensity work, which is what you'd kind of expect, but no one had kind of shown it in a paper from this point. So what we found is that sprint power typically suffered more after the high-intensity work. 3-minute power also looks like it's affected more. But actually, there's longer power outputs or durations, so your 12 minutes and your critical power probably doesn't make too much of a difference where the kind of the work is accumulated for those longer durations. So it seems that high intensity work hits harder on your ability to then do in high intensity work afterwards at a group level, I would say.
Mm. Do you have any theories for why that might be?
I think glycogen depletion will be one of them, especially around, you know, the sort of, we saw a big decrease in W prime after the high intensity session, but not after the moderate. So I think glycogen depletion, probably some neuromuscular stuff as well. So I think going above critical power will induce obviously some changes within the muscles, some metabolites that give a negative feedback loop to your body in terms of being able to produce subsequent power outputs. So I think it's just a case of, yeah, there's more going on when you ride above critical power and things get, you know, there's a lot more fatigue inducing metabolites that get produced, and then that negatively affects your ability to produce power afterwards.
Yeah, and it makes sense that with the longer, obviously, as you said, W prime being more affected, then that has a much bigger impact on those shorter durations, like a 3-minute effort or a 5-minute effort, compared to a 10 or 20-minute effort, even though it does have an impact on those durations. So one follow-up question I had on this one is actually, why did you choose to use the moderate intensity domain to compare and against high intensity? Why not the heavy intensity domain? Or is that something you have thought about doing in the future or as future work?
We use the moderate just because to be as far away from the severe as possible, essentially, to really separate that out and say, okay, like moderate, we didn't have the time to do moderate, heavy, and severe with the athletes that we had. So that would have been a perfect way to do that study, but unfortunately, we just didn't have the time it was done in professional cyclists, and we only had so many days between, you know, on training camps and whatever else. So that's why we chose to do the moderate. I think, from the data kind of the unpublished data from my PhD, I think it looks like heavy is just like a slight increase on moderate, if that makes sense. So going back to that kind of anecdote I said about the testing and how it kind of all went wrong to start with, actually, those athletes that stayed in the heavy exercise intensity domain during those efforts, even though they shouldn't have, we didn't see much fatigue in those athletes. So I think heavy is, basically an intermediate step between the two, but I think it looks a lot more like moderate than it does like severe exercise intensity domain. Yeah. What you might see at that point is increased glycogen depletion. So I would hypothesize that it would hurt your W prime quite a lot as well, potentially the heavy exercise intensity domain, especially if it was for a prolonged period. Now, what I would say is all these findings are at a group level. So there's obviously also on top of that big inter-individual differences. And actually some athletes didn't matter what you threw at them. So we categorized those athletes as fatigue resistant, we called them. And essentially after both the moderate and the high intensity work, their power profile just didn't change. Pretty much the same power outputs. Then we had some athletes that we classified as semi-fatigable, which is that after the high intensity work, we did see a change in their power profile, but after the moderate, we didn't. And then we had some athletes that we categorized as fatigable, and basically we saw a similar change in their power profile, both after the moderate and after the high intensity work. So there's inter-individual differences there, obviously, also in the response to intensity.
And were there any patterns for which types of cyclists, for example, might be fatigue resistant versus fatigable, or anything that you could see, or was it more random?
No, there wasn't any patterns in this data. I know kind of other colleagues have shown that basically an athlete's ability to hold a certain portion of their power duration relationship is related to their speciality. So for example, better sprinters are able to hold their sprint power outputs better than less good sprinters, if you like. But actually we don't see a big change in, big difference in, for example, longer power outputs, like 20 minute power outputs. And it's probably a bit the inverse for climbers. What we did see in this study was that if an athlete was able to maintain their 15-second power output after high-intensity work, then they were durable across the board. Now, I don't know if that was maybe just in the cohort that we had, but that's what we saw in the athletes that we had. I don't know how well that expands to other athletes, but pretty much if you can maintain your sprint power after high-intensity work, it's likely that your three-minute, your W prime will also being less affected by high intensity work. And then also we don't see a big difference in the longer durations anyway. So if you want to use a good quick way of seeing if an athlete may be durable or not, maybe do some sprint testing, then maybe do some high intensity work with them, then do some sprint testing afterwards. And that might give you a good idea quickly. Won't be perfect, but it will get, it saves going through the entire kind of rigmarole of controlling and doing it twice and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And I think that one thing that I want to highlight from this work is that I think in the last, I don't know, decade or so, when people have been talking about durability, or it has also been called fatigue resistance, especially in people familiar with WKO will have seen those fatigue resistance charts with the power duration curve after 2000 kilojoules, for example. So that's the way that it was from my understanding, at least, initially conceptualized, that how much power can you produce after a certain amount of work, and how little do you lose after a certain amount of work. But what you have showed here is that it's not just the amount of work done, but it's that how the work is done that also matters and impacts this. So this is important to keep in mind. And obviously, maybe for triathletes, if you're going to race long distance triathlon and you're always going to be in the moderate or maybe heavy domain, then probably work done is a really good proxy that you can use. But for a discipline like cycling or for short distance triathlon, then you have to take into account how is the work done, in what intense domain are you working.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, as you say, it was always been just quantified in terms of absolute number of kilojoules or normalized to body mass, so like 40, 50 kilojoules per kilo. But yeah, that doesn't seem to be enough. So we do need some kind of intensity metric in there as well.
Yeah. Any other takeaways from this study in particular?
No, I don't think so. I think, again, it, you know, just kind of what I was quite happy with about my PhD is that all the findings pointed in the same direction. Do you know what I mean? Like we know that, okay, it would also make sense that if, you know, glycogen depletion is important, the guys that do intensity, that's going to hit your glycogen stores a bit more, which means, you know, you're likely going to see a change in W prime, etc. So it just kind of meshed in nicely also with what we found in all the other studies, which was nice to see.
Yeah. Then some general follow-up questions on all of this is, can you speculate about how these findings, these results might apply or potentially be different in a cohort of amateur cyclists? Because all of your work was in professional or under 23 cyclists, so athletes on a very high level.
Yeah, so I think what you can do is, as you say, all our work was done in, you know, kind of continental level cyclists, that third tier of professional cycling, actually some second tier athletes as well. If you go then to world-class cyclists, basically you just have to ramp everything up. So the total amount of work to induce the same amount of downward shift in the power duration relationship needs to be more. So, you know, rather than looking at 2,500 kilojoules, you probably need to be looking at 3,500 kilojoules before you start seeing these differences. And with amateur cyclists, it just goes the other way. So you might be looking at, you know, 1,500 or 2,000 kilojoules before you start seeing, you know, differences depending on the level of that athlete. So I think, you know, you will still see this downward shift. It might just happen quicker and it might just happen to a greater degree in amateur cyclists, depending on their level of performance.
Yeah. And the other general follow-up question, you already mentioned one aspect of this, how do you improve durability and volume came up, which is not surprising. Are there any other things that you, whether it's from these studies or from just reading other people's work or experimenting in the field as a coach, do you have any thoughts on how to work on durability? How can you improve it?
Yeah, so fueling is a big one. That we didn't look at all deliberately in my PhD. So throughout all my PhD work, we basically fueled everyone pretty highly. So we used 90 grams of carbohydrates, kind of 1:0.8 glucose fructose ratio. So we really fueled them as if it was racing. But if you're not fueling, then obviously you're going to see greater glycogen depletion. You know, you're not going to provide muscles with as much fuel source, and that's going to impact your ability for sure. And that's, I think, why we see now, especially in professional cycling, like really high carbohydrate intakes. So I think fueling is a big one. And then I think on top of that, just good, controlled, sensible training. Do you know what I mean? Like I think, you know, when athletes are in good form and they feel fresh, but they also feel fit, is when you're going to see the most durable athletes. It's, you know, just get your just do the basics really well. In terms of your training, make sure there's enough volume in there. If you do need to improve durability, kind of lean on the volume side of things, but don't overdo it in any area. And I think then you know you'll get your most durable, well-performing athletes. I think we should not also forget about the fresh values, right? Because the fresh values set the ceiling. You're never going to do more in a fatigue state than you are in a fresh state. And so, you know, they also have to be considered in terms of, like, they need to be high enough, and then you need to be able to match them in a fatigue state.
Yeah, yeah. What are your thoughts? There is one thing that has been talked about and used is doing efforts in a fatigued state in training, and that always. I'm not sure about my own thoughts about that personally, to be honest. But I guess I'm leaning more towards the side that will kind of just, it would be a demonstration of your durability. But I'm not convinced that it will improve your durability to just do efforts when you're fatigued in training. Not that it's necessarily worse than doing it when fresh, but what, do you have any thoughts on that? Is that something that you use a lot?
I don't use it as a way to move durability if that's what I'm trying to improve with an athlete. Yeah. In that case, I kind of lean on the volume and then keep the, you know, kind of separate it out and keep that high intensity sessions high intensity focused, and then the longer sessions endurance focused. I think where it can be good is like a confidence booster for athletes. So if they see coming into an important race block that, you know, they're able to suddenly do better numbers in a fatigue state, I think that's really good for their confidence. And then that can, you know, obviously help them in races as well. But I wouldn't use it as a tool per se to try and improve durability. I would kind of separate those things out and just, you know, like I say, basic good training that we've, you know, we've actually done for years. Like this is the whole thing with durability, right? Nothing's new under the sun. Kind of, you know, this has all been done. Oh, you know, people have always been aware that you need to be good at the end of a race as well as at the beginning of a race. Mm. I think where the difference nowadays is that we've kind of just studied it a bit more systematically and we understand it a bit better. But it's not like it's, you know, it's not like coaches 50 years ago weren't thinking about how good their athletes were at the end of, you know, the end of races as well.
Yeah. So then there is one more study that I want to touch on, which is a bit different, not related specifically to durability. That is a viewpoint that you wrote with some colleagues regarding in the scientific literature using VO2 max as a marker of the level of the athletes and how that's potentially not the best, most optimal marker to use, and maybe replacing it with something like critical power or critical speed. So can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, so this is us kind of kicking the hornet's nest a little bit of exercise physiology over the last 40, 50 years or whatever. So we always classify athletes by VO2 max. So basically, whenever you do an intervention study, you know, you get them in the lab, first of all, you do a ramp test with them, VO2 max, boom, it's over 75. Everyone says they have elite athletes in their studies. They don't have elite athletes in the studies. When you look at like the sustainable power outputs, when you look at the numbers that the often participants in studies are doing, these are nowhere near elite athletes. And so the magnitude of improvement that you will see or likely to see in those athletes is much greater than you will ever see in, you know, true elite athletes. And I think we've gone down a road a little bit where the classification systems around VO2 max actually were VO2 max plus a few other things like training volume, level of competition, etc. And those things have been forgotten. And now everyone kind of focuses just on the VO2 max number. And as long as it's, you know, above 75, everyone says, okay, like we've got elite athletes. And actually it's not that hard to get to 75 or find people that have VO2 maxes of 75. If you've got good, you know, university level athletes, which is obviously the cohorts where you can do a lot of work when you're, you know, working at a university. So we proposed that instead of using VO2 max, we use critical power or critical speed, critical pace as the measure. So yes, it's still, you know, easily testable in a lab, but it's also testable in field situations. So, you know, you don't necessarily need a lab to be able to classify your participants really well. It's much more relatable to what we see in, you know, elite athletes. Like you're never going to find a university level athlete training 500 hours a year that's got a critical power of 6.3, 6.4 watts per kilo, something like that, you know, in cycling. It's just, if you do, then, you know, give me their number and I'll, you know, we'll kind of sign them up straight away, basically. So it seems to be a much more robust way of actually getting a good idea quickly of someone's actual performance level in terms of aerobic capacity. And so we proposed it as an alternative, essentially.
Do you think amateur athletes would benefit from looking more into these metrics than they already are? I mean, a lot of people are using critical power, but then we still have, there's a lot of, like Swift has their ramp test as a big marker for setting your FTP, but in reality, it's basically a VO2 max test, or it's the way that you test VO2 max, so it's not really a measure of sustainable aerobic power. So is it something that you think at a training level outside of the scientific world, it would also be an important message to bring home?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it starts to delineate your zones as well in terms of, like, you know, I've spoke about now the effect of exercising above critical power versus below critical power. And we've seen that in terms of, you know, how it comes through in terms of subsequent performance, etc. So I think switching from other metrics to using critical power just gives you a bit more straight away. So it allows you to understand performance, understand physiology, understand if, you know, obviously whenever you estimate critical power, you also get a W prime estimate, which gives you can then derive a power duration relationship because you can calculate that. Like, I think it's just a simple test that gives you so much depth as a coach or an athlete that will allow you to control your training really nicely, retest your training really nicely, you know, see if it's worked, etc. So I always push people in the direction of critical power, or critical pace, critical speed, just because I think it works super nice as an easy test to tell you a lot of information quickly.
Yep. And what things should people think about when it comes to actually testing critical power? For example, with regard to protocol, what durations to choose, testing on the same day versus different days, what would you recommend?
Yeah, so this is where it gets complicated. So this is where it is a little bit of a minefield. So the critical power model is applicable in the severe exercise intensity domain. So that's exercise intensities from the critical power upwards until a point where you will still reach VO2 max before you stop exercising. So for most athletes, that happens around the 2 minute mark. So if you exercise for 2 minutes, as hard as you possibly can, you'll probably just about hit VO2 max and then you'll stop and collapse in a heap on the side of the road. That's the domain of validity for the critical power model. So all of our testing needs to fall within that range of intensities. Okay, so the guidelines in the literature are between 3 and 15 minutes. So if you do multiple tests within that range of intensity, so maybe a 3, a 5, and a 12, for example, then no matter which way you estimate your critical power, so there's various mathematical ways of estimating your critical power once you have this data, and people get very wrapped up in, okay, which one do I use? Which one's better? Blah, 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 blah. Actually, if you do good testing, the difference is no matter which mathematical model you use are within a few percent, which is daily variation anyway. So it doesn't really matter which one you use after that. So what I would say is you want multiple durations between, let's say, 3 minutes and 15 minutes. Maybe with professional athletes, you can go up to 20 because they're a bit fitter and they can sustain power for longer and pace it better and whatever else. But for most people, between 3 and 15 minutes, ideally 3 tests. Because if you do 2 tests, when you plot them on a graph, any error in those 2 tests is going to also just completely knock your line out. So you've got no kind of room for error in terms of if you get your pacing wrong or if you're on a bad day or whatever else. So ideally 3 tests, 1 at 3 minutes, 1 at 5 to 8, something like that, and 1 12 minutes. And then you'll have all the data, you know, all the information that you need to do, get a good critical power and a good W prime estimate. In terms of doing it on 1 day or on 2 days, so if you do it on 1 day, you take out some daily variation, right? So you know, you're obviously slightly better on some days than you are on others, et cetera, et cetera. And if you do it across multiple days, that has an influence. And yeah, maybe, you know, you one of your 3 days is a slightly bad day. If you do it on 1 day, you have an influence from 1 test to the next test to the next test, potentially. So this is why we recommend at least 40 minutes between kind of efforts. What I typically do with athletes is do 2 on the same day. So maybe I do a 3 and a 12 minute on the same day, 40 minutes in between, super easy, get 2 maximal values. From that, I can already derive a critical power value. And then on a second day, somewhere else, I'll just tell them to go max in a 5 minute effort. And then I'll get that 5 minute effort as well, add that into my calculations. And then I've suddenly got a pretty robust critical power and W prime estimate. So that's what I would also recommend that other people do.
Mm. What I do as a coach is for the longest test, I actually use 20 minutes. So I use typically 3 minutes, 6 minutes, and 20 minutes. So what is the reason that I do that is, first of all, critical power does vary a bit depending on the test protocols you choose. And with a longer test, especially with amateur athletes that maybe are a bit weaker on the longer durations, you tend to get a slightly lower critical power value. But then I feel like in terms of delineating the zones, that works quite well, so that you don't go too hard when you want to train in the heavy domain. But the other reason is that, and one of the main reasons, to be honest, is that a lot of people have a lot of historical data for 20-minute tests because they've done a lot of FTP tests, 20-minute FTP tests. So then you get a comparison point. But yeah, I'm interested in hearing what are the downsides of choosing that 20-minute test, which is a little bit, and I am aware that it's a little bit longer than what is recommended in the scientific literature in that 15-minute range or shorter. So what would you say are the downsides of choosing that duration?
There's not so many downsides. So I actually also use 20 minutes with professional road athletes because, like you say, I have a lot of historical 20-minute data. The issues that you get are things like, do they have a 20-minute section of road where they can put out power? Or is there a 20-minute climb? Is there descents? Do you know what I mean? All those sorts of issues come in. So obviously the shorter the duration, just it's a little bit easier to find a 10-minute, you know, extended period of road where you don't have traffic lights or bits you have to slow down or whatever else than a 20-minute section of road. But in theory, if athletes pace it particularly, you know, if they're good at pacing a 20-minute test, they can get a maximum effort out and they've got, like, you know, a good section of road, you can also use a 20-minute test. It's absolutely fine. I think what I would say is you can probably go longer with your tests as the athletes become more experienced and they're at a higher level, just because they've done more and more of that. So I also use a 20-minute test with the professional athletes I use, but with, like, amateur athletes, I'd probably say like a 12-minute test works well, because, you know, or something that they've done previously a lot in training, you know, if they've done 15-minute efforts in training beforehand, so they're used to pacing that effort, I would maybe use a 15. The great thing is it doesn't matter. Like, you could use a fixed distance if you wanted as well, just go maximally from the bottom to the top of a climb. And as long as it was, you know, in the 12 to 15 minute range, you'd still have a maximal value, right? And you can just put in, you know, 14 minutes, 36 seconds or whatever the climb took you. There's actually quite a bit of flexibility there. I think what happened is people started putting in like 1 hour powers. They started putting in like really sub maximal efforts, and that skews all your kind of, you're outside of the zone of validity of the model. And so then you start getting problems. And I think, you know, if you're talking about professional athletes, they can sustain critical power for probably 40 minutes, something like that on a good day. So 20 minutes, you're absolutely fine in terms of being above the critical power. But I think once you're within 5% of it, then you're starting to get a little bit hazy. So I would say have your test durations somewhere where it's more than 105% of what you think the critical power is going to be, and then you'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. What we say for amateur athletes is the expected duration that they can hold critical power, 30 minutes or so?
Yeah, probably around that, yeah. So I think 25 to 45 minutes is you have quite a range there.
Yeah. Right. So I asked for some listener questions on Instagram. Listeners, you can follow Scientific Triathlon HQ, and I will try to do this as well, starting to do with some interviews to ask for questions in advance. So I think I have two questions that I put in here for today, because we have answered a lot of the durability related questions already, but there are a couple of questions just generally in terms of the power duration curve and critical power. So the first one is from Lee, who is asking, how do you use the power profile to determine what areas to focus on? Specifically, do you have rough benchmarks or relationships between certain power values to help you determine if VO2 max or critical power needs a focus?
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of Phil Skiba's model. So the house model, as he calls it, where you plot your physiological threshold. So your LT1 or VT1 power output, your critical power, your power at VO2 max. And I know that's a little bit dubious in terms of how you measure that, but it still gives you a good idea. And then your sprint power, and you look at the percentage difference between those things. You know, like, I think have you had Phil on the podcast?
Yes, I have a couple of times.
Yeah. So obviously Phil kind of pushed that model in his most recent book. I don't know if it was in the first one. And yeah, that gives you a really good idea of strengths and weaknesses straight away. Like, you know, if LT1 is 95% of critical power, it's just not going to move up until you move critical power up above it. You know, so I think that's a really nice way of looking at the relationship between the physiological thresholds, and then using that to determine, okay, what are my training priorities? And obviously you've got to look at the event as well. You know, it's not no good just making an athlete better. Like, you need to make an athlete better in a way that's also going to have, you know, a beneficial performance effect in races.
So are you always then, or, well, that's probably evident that it's not always one thing or the other, but do you think that in general, for most, especially because this is triathlon show, so I'm going to ask you to move hypothetically into the realm of especially amateur triathletes, and most of the listeners are maybe focusing on races that take them 2 hours to 16 hours from, let's say, Olympic distance to Ironman, or 1 hour to 16 hours, but let's call it Olympic distance and upwards. Would you focus first on moving the lower values up if there is room to grow, and up until what point would you do that? For example, if you have the LT1 power, critical power, and you have something like a, let's call it a 5 minute mean max power as a proxy for VO2 max, if you think that that's reasonable, can you say specific benchmarks? That is it 95% of LT1 and CP, because that sounds very high, or is it something else?
Yeah, so I think the benchmarks are a little bit hazy, but I would say anything above, let's say 85% LT1 to CP is high. Mm. And so you're probably not going to move it much higher than that, you know, without moving critical power up first. And so you might want to kind of focus on that. But if critical power is really, you know, high as a percentage of let's say 5 minute power output, actually you probably need to do some kind of work to move that total aerobic capacity upwards, to move the bottom one upwards, if that makes sense. Mm. I think you also have to look at it in terms of the context of historical training as well. So if you've, you know, done a big volume block with an athlete and you still think like, okay, we're only at 70% with LT1 of CP, but we've done like a huge training block, then maybe that's just not the stimulus that athlete needs. And you need to kind of, you know, maybe mix it up a little bit. And actually sometimes maybe moving one of your other components will pull the LT1 up with it. So I think it's just a nice visualization tool. And actually quite often I just, you know, have an Excel sheet that actually plots it out as a little house, and I show athletes that just as filled as in the book. And then, you know, we talk about that in terms of both contextualize that in terms of the training data across the last 6 months or 12 months. You know, if you've already got really high volumes, then, you know, how much are you going to be able to move things by? And also what will come through in terms of performance in races.
Yeah. And just one more, if I can push you for one more benchmark in terms of the critical power as a percentage of whether it's 5 minutes power, or if you want to call it power at VO2 max, do you have a benchmark for at what point is critical power so close that you're unlikely to move it further without improving VO2 max?
So for that one, I'll look at the ratio of CP to W prime rather than the 5 minute. Obviously, you could back calculate it. So, you know, if you've got, and how, that's one where I would look at more how likely is it that that's going to be a beneficial in a race. You know what I mean? So like if you've got a W prime of 25 kilojoules and you're an Ironman triathlete, is moving it to 30 really going to be beneficial? Probably not. You're not going to use it at all. You know what I mean? In your race. But if you're a punchy road cyclist, for example, and there's some uphill finishes, yeah, that might be really beneficial. So there I look at more the ratio of CP to W prime and see what's going to be beneficial from a performance perspective in terms of moving that.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. I can also, because Lee asks about some comparing 3 minute and 12 minute power, for example, I actually have a lot of data on that in a spreadsheet myself. So I can give a bit of an answer from my side. And this is all based in, or no, not all of it, but most of the athletes in my database are triathletes. So if I recall correctly, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the average from pretty relatively advanced, a mixed cohort, but I would say intermediate plus level age group triathletes was that 12-minute power was around 80 to 81% of 3-minute power, but the range there was, let's say, 72 to 88%, something like that. So I felt that at if you're around 80%, you can still improve 12 minutes as a compared to 3 minutes a bit more. But if you're approaching that kind of 85% plus or 12 minutes as 3 minute power, then you're getting to the boundary, at least in the cohort of data that I have for those particular test durations.
I've never actually looked at the ratio of 3 to 12 myself. I always look at the CPW prime.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting. I've never done that myself, so that's certainly something that I'm going to be looking at going forward. And then the other listener question that I want to ask here is from Nathan, who's asking, how can you flatten your power curve? Mine is very steep with 2,000 watts for 5 seconds and 260 watts and nine for 90 minutes, and this is for long distance triathlon.
was going to say, that's not a road cyclist, because that would actually be a very nice profile to have with 2,000 watts for 5 seconds. I think you want to do it by moving the bottom up as much as possible, right? So, you know, it's going to flatten out, but I don't think you should focus on reducing the sprint power. I think that will just come as a natural result of doing more aerobic training, but you just need to move that asymptote and the LT1 and the CP up. So you're probably looking at volume. In that case as well, probably because you've got obviously quite a high sprint capacity, you could probably get away with doing a lot of sweet spot sort of work as well, because, you know, you've got some room to lose, if that makes sense, in terms of the very high intensity. And we might see, you know, with that sort of work, some transition from fast twitch to slow twitch fibers, or at least an improved oxidative capacity of some of the fast twitch fibers. So increase your training load. Some sweet spot work would probably be beneficial in that circumstance. Increase the volume.
This is a follow-up question from my side here, but for somebody that is very punchy, like this athlete, do you manipulate the low intensity training in any way, for example, by like somebody that has an 800 or 700 watt 5 second sprint, which is where I am. I tend to see that those kinds of profiles can do their low intensity training a bit harder, and it's no problem. But sometimes the ones that have a really high capacity to produce short duration power, they tend to benefit sometimes for the sustainability of the training, to just do the easy training really, really easy. So be really, is that something that you see as well?
Yeah, definitely. Especially in road cycling, we're interested in maintaining that sprint capacity, right? So we want endurance athletes that can sprint as quickly as possible. And so we when we do endurance races, endurance work, because obviously these athletes still need to get through grand tours, we're really careful with that work and the intensity of that work. So we keep it probably, much easier with the sprinter type athletes, just to make sure, just to minimize the effect on their absolute power outputs. You know, there's pure sprint power outputs as much as possible. So we will go easier with those athletes. Whereas the athletes, for example, climbers, where, you know, it's always funny watching climbers sprint together. Like, you know, it's a battle of who can hit 1,000 watts. Those athletes, you don't need to worry about hitting the sprint, you know, affecting the sprint power negatively too much. So they can probably ramp it up a little bit, because they'll also in races do a lot of, you know, sort of heavy intensity work on climbs and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And I think it also, it kind of something that I talked with Phil Bellinger about when they have done the magnetic resonance spectroscopy based muscle fiber typology studies, that, it's not exactly the same, to be honest. They have more looked at increasing volume, and the slow twitch type athletes respond well to that, whereas the more fast twitch dominant athletes, that they tend to get overreached much more easily. But from an anecdotal perspective, I kind of look at it and have seen it a bit in the way also that you do your endurance training, but with the more fast twitch dominant athletes, doing it much more easily helps you avoid that domain of overreaching or overtraining even. Very anecdotal, but that's maybe something that I would say with when it comes to that, adding that volume and that endurance training.
Yeah, and I think like anecdotal evidence is still, you know, it's still evidence, and I think like I think the broad strokes of training prescription can come from research, and you know that's what the point I was trying to make earlier about we weren't looking for specific answers, we were looking for like broad stroke directions that we can point coaches in. How it's then applied to the individual athlete, there's so many variables in that. Like, we have to use, you know, anecdotal evidence, and we have to use feedback from the athlete about how they feel and how they, you know, how they feel they respond to it, and what we see in their own data and whatever else. Like, that's the only way we can actually apply it. So that sort of stuff shouldn't be ignored.
Yep. All right. That's all the questions that I had. Do you have any final take-home messages or conclusions?
I think what I would say is everything that I've spoke about is single session durability. Hardly any work has been done on day-to-day durability so far. which is obviously a massive area, especially in road cycling. You know, we have 3 week long races. Are there training modalities, interventions, etc., that can improve day-to-day durability would be a really interesting question. And that's hopefully someone else will pick up that baton with their own PhD and kind of take it in that direction and look at day-to-day durability. That'd be super interesting. So I think that's kind of probably the next area to explore with durability research.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. All right. So where can listeners follow you?
I'm on Twitter. It's probably the best place. I think my Twitter name is Sprag_perform.
Performance. Yeah. I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. Yeah, Twitter is probably the best place to follow me. That's where I kind of post the most things and stuff. Not as much as I did when I was doing my PhD. I've got a little bit less time now with the job, but yeah, there's still anything I find interesting goes up on Twitter. So.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thank you so much, James, for this. It's been great to have a chat, and I hope to do it again another time.
No, thank you very much for having me back.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. I will link to a lot of the papers, all of the papers that we discussed, except one that is still in review. But all of the other ones I will have linked to, and also to related episodes, including James' previous appearance on the podcast, as well as his colleagues Peter Leo and Tim Podlogar have both been on before. And he also mentioned Philip Skiba, and I will link to those episodes as well. So if any of those names sound like you haven't heard them on the podcast, I recommend going and listening to those episodes, because they were all really great, really insightful interviews. Some of my personal takeaways from this interview is number one, not surprising at all, but the relationship between training load and specifically training volume and durability. There just are no shortcuts here. Just get the work done if you want to be strong at the end of the race, not just at the beginning. You might be able to fake it a bit more with really good fresh power numbers, but to have really good end of race power numbers, then yeah, you just have to get the work done. And that's something we discussed when James talked about how some juniors coming through the ranks now have really good fresh power numbers, but it takes years of training to get to be at the first one across the finish line in a long competitive race. Number two is that in terms of the physiological markers and their relationship with durability, it was really interesting that the regression analysis that was done revealed that combining VO2 max, growth efficiency, and substrate utilization was the best combination of explaining the largest variance in terms of durability. And like James said, it nicely demonstrates that durability is composed of physiological components of various kinds, including both, let's call it the size of the engine in terms of VO2 max, but also the mechanical and metabolic efficiency of the engine. So training in a holistic way, focusing on different aspects of physiology, also nicely targets durability. No need to put all your eggs in one basket. And finally, I think we had a really nice discussion around critical power and critical speed. And my opinion here is pretty strong, I would say, but I think it's still very underappreciated among the masses in general media and general training lore, not just in science. Obviously, the Viewpoint publication that James was involved in that led to the discussion was more from a scientific point of view, that critical power, critical speed is a better marker of performance physiology than VO2 max, which I completely agree with. And I just want to extend that viewpoint to training and especially in amateurs. I think that there is still a very large tendency to focus on FTP. And especially for triathlete, I think that we would benefit much, much more from using critical power, critical speed, because our races are so long and steady oftentimes that to get any kind of mean max power or pace data from them is just, you're not going to get that. You're never doing maximal efforts really in racing. The duration makes it maximal at the end, but it's not maximal for the durations that you're doing. For cyclists, however, that do race, then you might be able to, you don't necessarily need to do formal testing if that's something that you dislike, because if you race, you might get a lot of good mean max power data from racing efforts, and you end up knowing automatically which durations and which kinds of efforts you're good at and which ones you're not so good at. So there I can see that, okay, maybe it is slightly less necessary to do formal critical power testing if you anyway can know, roughly speaking, roughly where your threshold is. You don't need to do critical power testing for that necessarily, in my opinion. But the profiling aspect of critical power is what I really think makes it the best marker, the best, most important test that we can do as athletes compared to other kind of threshold tests. But yeah, again, cyclists, maybe there is slightly less need, even though I think it's obviously still really good for most cyclists to do. But for triathletes, I just don't think we do those sorts of efforts, neither in training or racing, to really be able to get an accurate insight into where we are strong and how our performance across different durations relate without doing that kind of formal testing. And I think, so again, that's the profiling that is really, really valuable, even if you could do if you say that, well, I can get an accurate threshold estimate by doing something longer, like an hour of power, for example, rather than a typical 20-minute test. That is true, but you still lack the profiling. You still only have one data point. So there you have it. That's why I think that most athletes would benefit from using critical power or critical speed as their, let's call it, threshold marker and their way of profiling themselves as athletes. Now, a quick housekeeping item. By the time of recording this, we are just finalizing the recruitment process of adding a new coach to the Scientific Triathlon team. When you hear this episode, that will be completed. The new coach will be taking on athletes already, so we now have a better availability of coaching slots, which has been challenging the last few months with not so much availability. And I will make a more official announcement once everything is finalized, but I just want to put it out there that although I'm not yet saying who they are and what their name is, we do now have a new, very skilled, very experienced coach across all race distances and performance level that is taking on athletes who I am really, really excited to work alongside. So if you're looking for a new coach, now would be a great time to reach out and schedule a discovery call. Of course, remember as well that if coaching is out of your budget, we do have other options. We have customized plans and we have ready-made plans, and we also have consultations. So you can reach out and we can have a discussion around which options best suit you and your goals and your budget. All of the information about all of this can, of course, also be found on scientifictriathlon.com. In the next episode of the podcast, we have Björn Gesman returning to the show. He's the coach of Kat Matthews, Patrick Lange, Jan Stratmann, and I'm probably forgetting somebody, some really good world-class athlete. But I wanted to ask anybody that has questions for Björn, listener questions that they want answered on the podcast, send them to me via email, michael@scientifictriathlon.com. And I will also put up an Instagram story soon asking for questions, so you can send them in there or just DM me. But to be honest, there is a risk that they disappear there. Email is the best way for sure to reach me in any kind of question. So I recommend emailing me. But any questions for Björn, then you can send them to me and I will try to ask some listener questions on the show like I did here with James. Also coming up is an interview with Rune Talsnes, who you probably maybe have not heard of, but he is a researcher and coach specializing in cross-country skiing. So we will discuss that and get some different kinds of insights into endurance training from the perspective of cross-country skiing, but also tackling some interesting general endurance training questions that he has studied in his research. That's it for today. Big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorite. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Swim Trainer is a great tool to have in your toolbox to improve your technique and power, to target specific aspects of your stroke and to maintain consistency when you don't have time to get to the pool. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senatesinter.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.